This is Juvie, a podcast that explores cases, legislation, experiences, and ramifications of children and youth in juvenile and adult criminal justice systems.
Being young, naive, frightened, 16 years old, being overwhelmed emotionally and psychologically.
In my mind, I'm saying, well, if you're going to say I did it, I'm going to say you did it.
What does my mother know? I know better than her that I'm here helping the police, and she doesn't understand that.
And so he said, I'm going to ask you one more time, and if you don't tell me what I want to hear, I'm going to hit you in the head.
There's one thing that people almost invariably associate with childhood: home, comfort, reassurance, nurturing. Perhaps the most vivid and visceral memories that long-term prisoners have, memories that arouse strong feelings of deprivation and longing, are around food. When prisoners are released, they often head to a celebratory meal shared with family and friends. Food is perhaps the most concrete and immediate medium through which they can really believe that they're free again among those who care for them, able to make unrestricted and uncompromised choices. Food is perhaps symbolic of all our physical and emotional needs, our sense of safety, and what we have the power to bargain with. We can be manipulated or coerced into doing something against our will by being deprived of something, or being force-fed something unpleasant or threatening, or by the promise of something good that we'll receive if we cooperate. The proverbial choice between a carrot or a stick.
What food or meal has particular significance for you, and why?
Without a doubt, mussels with fraught diavolo sauce with Neapolitan ice cream. And the significance that it has is that that was my first meal. When I was released, we went to an Italian food restaurant, and I hadn't had that in 16 years. And so I had that. It's normally served with spaghetti, and I requested that they substitute the spaghetti for big ziti. And they did, and I wanted to have a Neapolitan ice cream for like a dessert, and it turned out the restaurant, so they sold strawberry, or they sold vanilla and chocolate either in combination, so I said put it all together, just make one, and it was great. In fact, the New York Times, they took a picture of me with the eating the ice cream like this, so in fact the spoon going, the ice cream going into my mouth, and my attorney and the law student who assisted her on my case are in the picture too.
You know, for me, I've come from a Southern background. I know my mom in particular, she's a very good cook, so for me, I just love her Southern fried chicken, for example. But of course, in prison, you're not privy to that sort of stuff, so you have to sort of settle for the prison food for the most part. But at the same time, there are instances where I get outside food packages. What I would try to do, or what I would try to choose, is meals that were kind of similar to what my mom would cook. For example, I would have chicken sent in and that sort of thing, because I always can, you know, reminisce about her food and the way she cooked. But of course, nobody can duplicate her style or her cooking. So, but I just wanted to just come as close as I could to that. So I would say chicken was a very huge part of my diet while I was incarcerated. One of the very first things I wanted to do, and I used to dream about this all the time during my entire 28 plus years in prison, was to think about my mom's cooking and how much I missed it, you know, and it, of course, brought a lot of sadness and tears and a lot of emotions and those sort of things. So, you know, one of the very first things that I wanted to do, and the very first real meal that I wanted to do, was have some of my mom cooking. So she did what she does best. So she made me some macaroni and cheese and some fried chicken, and sure enough, it was perfect. And just being able to eat her food brought so much emotion to me, I couldn't finish it at a reasonable rate, I would say, but I eventually got through with it, and it was a very good experience. And just, you know, tasting my mom's food once again, because there were times when I was in prison that I actually didn't think I would get the opportunity to do that again, you know, given what was happening to me with the criminal justice system and the legal system in general. So I was really grateful to have that meal, and, you know, she still cooks for me every now and then now, and it tastes the same, it never changes, so.
It tasted like freedom.
Oh, well, without a doubt, absolutely. So I'm walking down the street after I walked out of the court building, obviously, you know, you're basically free to go and do whatever you want. But for me, there's certain instances that need to be kind of done. So it's a certain thing that need to be had, you know, and done for me to really appreciate, well, my freedom.
Jeffrey Deskovic and David McCallum are two New York exonerees who were each arrested in the 1980s at age 16 and then convicted for crimes they did not commit. Jeffrey spent 16 years in prison and David, 29. Both were charged on the basis of false confessions they made to police after being interrogated, intimidated, threatened, and given false hope and promises about how they would be rewarded if they said what the police needed them to say. The preamble to and the circumstances under which their respective false confessions took place were very different, but the common aspects are striking, and both their accounts give us an in-depth insight into how any 16-year-old can be maneuvered into conceding that he did something that he in fact did not. Jeffrey, through his organization, the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice, is an advocate for and supporter of the innocent in prison and after they're released. He's also an educator on the subject of false testimony and confession and wrongful conviction. He outlines red flags that indicate that a confession might not be based on truth.
There are definite red flags that a confession may be false, from the prolonged interrogation, particularly when combined with food deprivation, misuse and abuse of the polygraph, if the statements in the confession are in contradiction to the known external evidence. So in my case, I said I hit the victim over the head with the Gatorade bottle, but the type of head injuries that she had could not have been caused by a bottle. There was no shattered glass found at the crime scene. There were no shards of glass found in the body. Certainly the age of the person being questioned. False confession experts have determined that although perfectly normal adults have given coerced false confessions, that particularly vulnerable populations include people with mental health issues as well as youth. In terms of the mental health issues, the reason for that is because people realize that they have mental health issues and they try to compensate for that by being compliant with authority figures, which of course is the recipe for disaster when those authority figures are police and they're looking to get a confession to close a case. If the language used exceeds the formal education, life experience, and sophistication of the suspect's age, then that's another red flag, the confession may be false. If it's a confession written by law enforcement rather than by the suspect, if law enforcement is asking yes-no questions as opposed to asking open-ended questions where a truly guilty person would have to fill in the blanks and be accurate. If a question incorporates an item about the crime and then shortly after that the accused makes a statement that puts that detail in, that's another red flag. I mean, certainly if it is a co-defendant situation, their narratives don't match up, the stories are different, that's another red flag. One of the more blatant red flags are when law enforcement interrupts the person who is confessing, corrects them that they've gotten a certain detail wrong. Here's the correct detail. Let's take it again from the top and let's start back again. That's another big red flag, whether the police have really withheld certain non-public facts or whether or not they've given that to the suspect or even to the media, either deliberately or unintentionally. You know, that's what's known in the interrogation world as contamination. So contamination has occurred, and that's another red flag. I mean, certainly if an interrogation is selectively audio or videotaped, so which is to say if it's not from beginning to end so that you don't see what's happened, or you don't hear what's happened prior to the person confessing, or if they're, you know, starting and stopping the tapes, I mean, that's kind of a common sense. Why are they stopping the tape? Well, they don't want certain things to be known, certain things to be recorded. So that's another red flag.
One good example of clearly manufactured testimony and eventual confession is that of Jay Wilds, the star witness in the murder conviction of Adnan Syed in Baltimore in the year 2000. After numerous absurdly inconsistent statements, much of which we can hear on tape, he testified in court to having helped Adnan Syed transport and bury the body of strangled victim Haemin Lee.
Have you heard the Jay Wilds interrogations as he's giving his statement? Not exactly a confession as such, except that he was supposedly there.
And he gets details wrong, by the way.
He says something, and then...
They're correcting him.
Yes, and it's so obvious because he says, oh, okay, I mean... I forgot.
Yeah, the voice don't change.
So it, obvious, you know, sort of, oh, sorry, I forgot the script. Oh, yes, I forgot you wanted me to say that instead of this.
Right.
But the tapping is so telling.
It's very,
it's very telling.
Telling. Vulnerability is a key attribute of someone who is selected to be coerced into making false statements. Vulnerability can take many different forms: an inconvenient record of criminal activity, lack of strong family support or parental presence, age, immaturity, intellectual deficit or emotional fragility. The vulnerability of potential targets for false confession is often complemented by other potential suspects who nevertheless have some kind of bargaining chip they can employ to deflect attention from themselves or to obtain lesser charges or sentencing. As long as they aid investigators in pinning the crime on some other vulnerable suspect around whom a convincing narrative and ostensible motive can be woven. Jay Wilds may have been persuaded to testify against Adnan Syed in order to bargain against having the police chase him down on other unrelated activities, or worse, have them charge him for the murder, which in his case would have been a capital offence. In the murder investigation of Meredith Kircher, the role of Rudy Gadet was downplayed, because once having arrested the wrong people, the authorities needed him to justify the wrongful arrests of Amanda Knox and Raffaele Sollecito. He was persuaded to give false testimony by the attractive prospect of having his sentence drastically reduced, a reward that he's benefiting from to this day. Potential suspects who might be elusive or difficult to convict are sometimes ignored or substituted by more vulnerable and readily available suspects.
The two boys, the ones that had stopped with the woman with the red car,
yes,
who it seems like the timing was very similar to the time that they might have hijacked the victim, whose name is
Nathan
Blenner.
Yes.
Why were they not followed up on?
You know, that's a very good question, and I think what happened, the theory now, at least without my legal team, is they could have been informants, because that's also a part of wrongful convictions too. We have informants in the neighborhood. What they do, they give information to local precincts. And local officers maybe have a relationship with these individuals for whatever reason. And what these guys do, so be it falsely or accurately, they give false information, they point fingers at individuals who may not have committed a crime, like Willie Stuckey and I. And so what they do and what they get in return is some sort of benefit. For example, if they got a criminal history or something like that, or a pending criminal case that they may want to get from out from under, they will give information up just so they can get skate on that particular charge that they're doing.
Right, so it's a murder case and they know that their information is going to be
very valuable.
I was actually the third suspect. Initially, the police were investigating the victim's stepfather, and he didn't have confidence in their police work that they were doing, and he had a sense that they were like targeting him. So that led him to hiring a retired police officer as an investigator to do his own investigation and try to solve the crime. And that kind of persuaded the police to move on from him to somebody else. Then they targeted another youth in the high school. So they started doing the same interrogation tactics that they later used on me, on him, with the difference being he had a stepfather in the home. And so he went to the police station, broke up the interrogation, and got his stepson an attorney. And so that was when they moved on from him onto me.
When groups of friends are involved, bringing all of them in for questioning can afford the police more leverage, playing them off against each other. So any verbal reference to or presence of other protagonists to extend the pool from an individual suspect is always worth following up on. David was brought into the police station along with his best friend, William Stuckey.
Tell me a little bit about William Stuckey, exactly how you and he got arrested. How you came to be involved with him, arrested with him. Did you happen to be with him, or how did that occur?
Oh, in fact, I was with him. On the day that this crime was said to have been committed, on October 20th, 1985, Willie and I was in a handball court in a park not far from where we live, where we were playing handball with my sister. So I can only assume, at least at that point, that's why he mentioned my name, because, in fact, we were together at that time in the handball court playing handball with my sister. So at that time, that's the only thing I can really ration as to why he would say what he said in terms of him being with me. And maybe perhaps my name was the first name that came to mind with him. So that's how they first mentioned my name.
Jeffrey, who the police had no reason to associate with the location where the murdered girl from his school was found, was arbitrarily identified as a potentially good suspect by his classmates, who said he was quiet and kept himself to himself. After the police apparently got nowhere with the first two suspects, Not having anything else to go on, it took several weeks and many repeated sessions of questioning before the police could bulldoze Jeffrey into a confession, and this only after having nurtured a complex and misleading relationship with him.
How did they bring you into the station each time? Did they pick you up unexpectedly?
Sometimes it would be by phone. Sometimes I would call them. Other times they would call my best friend to have him call me to let me know that the police would like to speak with me. At other times it involved them showing up. I live in an apartment complex, so like a parking lot was near the playground, and the public high school was across the street from my apartment building, so there was only one practical route of going, so they could figure out which route I was going to walk up this one street on Fremont Avenue.
So they would find you on the street even
sometimes.
It took 2 months.
Yes. Okay, so I'll explain. So for about 6 weeks, the police played this game with me, in which our interaction took on the following dynamic. Half the time, they would talk to me as if I was a suspect, and the other half the time, they would talk to me pretending they needed my help to solve the crime. So they would say things like, "Oh, the kids won't talk freely around us, they will around you. Let us know if you hear any rumors." They would ask me opinion questions and then congratulate me on my opinion. And then they would stop in from time to time. They paid all this attention to me. They made me feel important. They did the good cop, bad cop. All that interplayed two different ways psychologically. So first of all, my early childhood fantasy career, which most people engage in, was to be a police officer. So this unexpected early opportunity to do this quasi-police work, okay, in addition to my being naive, that's kind of how they pulled the wool over my eyes. That's part of it. The other part of it was my father was never involved in my life in any way, shape, form, or fashion. I never saw him. He was not a part of it, ever. So the officer who was pretending to be my friend, I began to look up to him as a positive male role model. So that was another aspect of it. They would talk to me as a suspect, and then when I'd start getting too frightened, then they'd go back to the helper things. So that was how that went.
Playing on this still childhood need to feel like you're important amongst a group of adults, which at 15, 16, is still partly there, isn't it? You want to feel that you're helping the adults.
Yes. You know,
because you're in that transition to becoming an adult, but you're not quite there. It's really exploitative to use that desire that naturally kids of that age are going to have to sort of want to feel like, oh, I'm maturing now and they're respecting my opinion and they're respecting my role. They're giving me a special, responsible role in this task.
That was part of it, clearly, yeah. For me.
Keeping parents out of interrogations, by opportunity or by design, forces kids to focus their attempts to get their needs met on investigators. Teenagers, for whom establishing an identity that boosts their self-esteem is an important preoccupation, coupled with striving for independence, which often involves distancing themselves from parents, are often all too ready to engage with adults who are not their parents, especially if these adults make them feel important.
Your mother obviously didn't know that you were being taken into custody to be questioned.
No, she did not.
Were you taken from home?
No, I was taken from a neighborhood candy store.
Okay, so there was no chance for your mother to be informed or anything, and it all happened in one session very quickly.
No, yes.
So your mother never even had a chance?
Not so.
Did you have a father in the home?
Yes, I did.
And so neither of your parents
Yes,
were
he was in the hospital.
Okay.
We just came from visiting in the hospital. And, you know, my mom told me to go back outside, stay in, got to go to school tomorrow. Right. This was on Sunday.
So basically, your parents were not involved, they weren't even given a chance to be involved. No. How many times over the course of those 6 weeks did you get called in and interrogated, and for about how long each time?
I don't recall exactly how many times. It was maybe once every 8 days, something like that. But it's clear from my accounts and from other documents that were obtained during the discovery phase of my lawsuit that there were more interactions and interrogations than what the police had actually documented. You know, in each session, which would be multi-hours, 2, 3, 4 hours at a time.
Was your mother present for any of your questioning sessions at all?
No.
Did she know they were taking place?
No. The police knew that my mother did not want me to be questioned by them.
I knew that my mother didn't want me to be questioned by them, but I was 16 years old. I mean, it is that time period where, you know, you're starting to stretch your wings. You want to have the freedom. There is that tension between the desire for freedom and that authority figure. The foolish line of thought, which I was guilty of. What does my mother know? I know better than her. Right? She doesn't understand what's going on here. I understand exactly what's going on here. And that of course, being driven by that I'm here helping the police. And she doesn't understand that. She thinks they're trying to do something to me. And she doesn't understand that I'm here to help them. And so that was the thought process under which these interviews would go.
Police are sometimes quite brazen in their attempts to obtain testimony against suspects, even away from the unseen confines of the police station. And they're not averse to massaging the representation of suspects to their associates, especially if it might persuade someone to cough up or even manufacture some dirt on that suspect. Aside from the immediate disastrous consequences of exaggerated, decontextualized, or false testimony, who knows how many friendships and family relationships are damaged irreparably by such planting of seeds of suspicion.
So tell me about the best friend. How did he get requisitioned into this?
Because the police questioned him also. This was all before the day of the false confession. So the police knew he was my best friend. Police went to his house. They questioned him and they told him and his parents that they suspected me of committing the crime and they were questioning him. And he told me afterwards that the police were trying to get him to say either that I admitted to committing the crime to him or else that he witnessed me committing the crime. But thank God he did not. I didn't have that additional false piece of evidence against me to wrestle with.
Was he ever called in to testify in court?
At the grand jury he was, but not at the trial.
David and his co-suspect, Stucky, were played off against each other in separate interrogation rooms, lied to by police about having testified against each other, leading both into actually falsely fingering each other in order to, as each saw it, protect himself from the ostensible, inexplicable lies of his friend in the other room.
Now, as far as implicating me into the crime itself, according to Willie, in the facts and investigations and evidence bears out that he falsely confessed, accusing me of the crime.
Did you do the same?
Yes, I did the same. Willie Stuckey was arrested about 3 hours before I was. So he was arrested around 7:30 of that day, and I was arrested about 10:30 that night. And so when he was in the precinct, and he had already falsely confessed. So what happened at that point was, after I was arrested, the detectives, they brought me to the precinct, they started asking me questions. And of course, when you're dealing with false confessions, what happens sometimes, particularly when you're dealing with two individuals, maybe three or four, maybe like the Central Park Five, for example, they did this method called the good cop, bad cop thing. At the time, I didn't realize that was being played on me, but now, on hindsight, of course, I do. So one cop would ask you about pedigree information, where you live, what sports you like, you know, who's your favorite NBA player, stuff like that. You know, what kind of, do you smoke cigarettes, that sort of thing. Then the next cop would come in, and he would be the more aggressive, right, in terms of language, you know, and posture. So that's, of course, it's designed to intimidate you. So that's what happened with me in that regard. They brought Willie to the door, and there Willie was, is that him, meaning me? He shook his head, yes. So in my mind, I'm saying, well, if you're going to say I did it, I'm going to say you did it, you know? And that's how we started pointing things at the other.
You were not in the same room. You were in separate rooms.
We were in separate rooms,
You had heard that he had fingered you, and
yes.
So you thought, okay, fine, then I'm going to finger you.
That's exactly
if you're doing that to me. How did you feel when they told you that?
Well, first of all, I couldn't believe it because, number one, I know he didn't do anything because we were together on that day that they said this crime was said to have been committed. So I know the crime was not true. And so I was upset and angry. I wasn't really thinking rationally at the time. The first thing I'm thinking, why would he say that about me when he knew we didn't do anything to begin with? But of course, as I laid on, as the anger started to subside a bit, I understood, because what they did to Willie, they did the same thing.
Over the 6 weeks and the several times that you went in to be interrogated, did the level of intimidation increase gradually over the course of the sessions until the final session when you actually confessed? Or was the level of intimidation up and down, like you were saying, one would play good cop, you know, you never knew whether you were in favour or not. Did it go up and down in each session, or did it increase incrementally across the sessions up to the moment where you felt so bad you felt you had to make a confession?
It was up and down each session, but keeping in mind, though, that only one cop was playing the good cop. They were not switching hats. It was up and down each interview, with the first one being more, then they eased up a little bit, and then the up-down each one, but not as severe as the first, keeping that at roughly the same level. And of course, the day of the coerced false confession, the intensity level being ratcheted up considerably.
For David, there was no prolonged preamble or relationship nurturing. They managed to compress the whole process from start to finish into a handful of hours.
You just had the one session, didn't you?
Yes, one session, yes.
About a 3 or 4 hour session. And
that was it.
Did it start out fairly friendly and then...
Yes. When I first got into the precinct, we had what they call a DC. He called it Manjab, which is obviously another phrase for it. And it's a
good... Can you say it? Mutt?
It's called Mutt and Jeff.
M-U-T-T and Jeff.
Yes.
One cop comes in, he plays the Philly voice, says, oh, you know, but, hey, man, you know, where you live? So you tell him where you live. How long you been living there? I should be over there and all that kind of stuff. And, you like sports? And, you know, me personally, yes. Well, you like football? Yeah.
Trying to build rapport, in other words, exactly. and camaraderie.
And stark contrast, the other guy comes in, and all of a sudden, you just, and the body language just completely changes on the guy. He comes in there with this posture, and then all of a sudden, then here comes the tone of the voice, the more aggressive tone. And that's also designed to intimidate.
Even if teenagers are not alone, the presence of parents can itself be exploited into detrimental effects.
One of the detectives said, had told me, he said, well, we're friends, so it's okay if we talk.
Your mother didn't want you to be questioned, but you've already explained how you just kind of went against that. But what you said about, you didn't have a male figure in your life to intervene for you.
Yes.
What was very noticeable when I was watching the Central Park 5 documentary was Antron. His father and mother were called in. Apparently they called out his father and obviously said something to make his father think that there was some evidence against his son. This seems to be a recurring tactic as well, as you get the parent to try to persuade the child to confess. Yeah. So the father came in, and it's obvious they'd done some work on him, and he came in and said, come on, you need to tell these people what they need to hear. And Antron said that if his father had stood his ground for him on his behalf, he would have stuck to the truth. Oh. He wouldn't have caved in. But the way he saw it was that his father was there pretty much being passive and not doing anything.
Hmm.
His father sat there and didn't really participate, didn't really say anything. And then what eventually happened is his father kind of dropped out of his life once he was convicted.
Right.
His father disappeared.
Hmm.
And came back again when he was released and died shortly afterwards. But his relationship with his father was never recuperated. But it's very interesting that he said that mm-hmm. his dad was physically there, right there in the room. You can see him in the video.
Right.
But he didn't stand up for him. He didn't encourage him to stay on his ground. No. The truth. And that sort of lack of parental support is very, very significant.
Oh, absolutely.
Very significant.
Absolutely.
Whether a lack of presence or a lack of seeming to be standing up for you when you're there.
Or even worse, which has happened, where the police ineffectively turn the parents into their agent, turn them into an agent of coercion.
Yeah.
Come on, just let's get out of here. Just tell them what you did. Look, they know that you did it.
Yeah.
You're just making it worse for yourself.
So periodically, they would try to get me to take a polygraph test. Eventually, they got me to agree to take the test by telling me that there was some new information which had just come in that was in their file that they wanted to share with me, and that this would put me in a better position to assist them. But for them to share that with me, I would first have to take and pass a polygraph. So the next day, rather than report to school, I went to the police station for the test. I thought that the polygraph was going to take place at the police station because I had heard from the rumor mill that other people had been polygraphed. So instead of doing the polygraph at the police station, they instead drove me out of county from Peekskill, New York, which is in Westchester County. They drove me to the town of Brewster, which was in Putnam County, 40 minutes away. That fact is important because that meant that I was no longer able to leave on my own. I was instead dependent upon the police.
They made me the center of the attention. They made me feel important. I think the key difference, though, in the 6 weeks and the day of the false confession is that the Peekskill police were only willing to go but so far themselves. So the whole purpose of them bringing me to the polygraph is driving me from Peekskill, which was in Westchester County,
driving me out of county to Putnam County, which is in the town of Brewster, 40 minutes away, was that they delivered me into the hands of, in effect, this hired gun, this Putnam County Sheriff's Investigator, who employed, as he testified to, this get-the-confession technique.
The crime took place in your county.
Yes.
And your initial interrogations were in your local police
yes.
station.
Mm-hmm.
Are they allowed to do that, take you out of county to another police station?
Yeah, it's not illegal because, I mean, they wouldn't have said that they wouldn't have admitted it that they did, and it was never ruled inadmissible based upon that.
There were three officers there who I knew were cops because they came with me from Peekskill. But there was also the polygraphist, who was a Putnam County Sheriff's Investigator. But he was dressed as a civilian. He was pretending not to be a cop. So I didn't have an attorney present. They didn't give me anything to eat the entire time I was there. They put me in a small room. The polygraphist started giving me countless cups of coffee, the purpose of which was to get me nervous. And after finishing that, they attached the polygraph machine to me. And the polygraphist then started interrogating me. He used a lot of third-degree scare tactics. He invaded my personal space. He raised his voice at me. He kept asking me the same questions over and over again. So as each hour passes by, my fear is increasing in proportion to the time. He kept that up for 6.5 to 7 hours.
The polygraph expert that my lawyer, my civil rights lawyers retained, looked at what happened, and they said there were a number of irregularities, that first of all, the maximum length of time that a polygraph should go on is 3 hours, and for me it was 6.5 to 7, so they more than doubled it up, and they said that to leave somebody attached to a polygraph machine like that is abusive. That really this was no real polygraph, that this was just an interrogation masked as a polygraph. And they also said that if my account of events was to be believed, then raising your voice and invading personal space, these are all things which were not supposed to be done. Video or audio taping of polygraphs is supposed to be done per the Arthur method of conducting polygraph, which is what the polygraphist was trained in. He didn't video or audio tape it, even though that method, its structure is supposed to, because the Arthur method produces a lot of false confessions, and so the audio and video tape recording is supposed to be a safeguard as against that happening. His polygraph test charts that he claimed that he looked at in order to draw his conclusion that I was lying and denying guilt. Those charts came up missing. They're still missing to this day, so it was impossible for any other polygraphist to look at it. During the depositions, I mean, on one hand, he admits that I'm factually innocent, and yet he couldn't explain, well, why is it you said that Jeff lied? You drew a lying reaction from Jeff when he denied committing the crime when you've already, how could you say that, and yet you're saying he's innocent?
The polygraph is associated with being a supposed lie detector, when in actual fact it's more about picking up on stress and this simplistic idea that the only stress you can experience in an interrogation is because you're lying and you know it, which is why they're not admissible in court in most states.
And just to point out for context that intelligence officers are trained how to beat the polygraph test if in fact they're captured, just
right.
In a different spying and different intelligence, different context, but just to show the extreme fallibility of a polygraph.
Absolutely. The way you describe the way they hooked you up to the polygraph,
yes.
It sounds as though they made it sound ever so benign. And
yes.
Did you understand at 16 that that's what polygraphs were generally used for, however erroneously, that a polygraph test was technically a lie detector? Did you understand that's what it was? Did you have any knowledge of that at the time?
I knew it was called a lie detector. And
you did know that?
I did know that, and that was it. But I didn't understand that he was there to try to get a confession. As far as I knew, I was taking a polygraph so I could be more helpful to the police, which they had convinced me that I could be. I could be more helpful to them as their junior co-detective. And the only way I could get to that place would be I would have to pass the polygraph. So I thought that I was almost amongst quasi-colleagues. I did not understand that I was there as a murder suspect and they were trying to get a confession from me so that they could falsely arrest me and send me away for 16 years. I did not understand that.
We just want to make sure that your answers are true with this little piece of special information that we're giving you in your special capacity that you have as our junior investigator.
Yeah, exactly. I thought this was like the end of this dynamic of half the time you're talking to me as if I'm a suspect, half the time as your helper. I thought this was the end of that dynamic, that after this was permanently putting to bed this talking to me as a suspect at all. This was the end of all of that.
The recurring theme in false confessions is the psychological torment, which occurs in different ways, whether it's manipulating you to feel aggressive towards your friend who's just supposedly fingered you in the next room, feeling guilty about what your parents are going to think.
Including making it seem as though if you did commit the crime, then you were likely thinking this or that. And so it's all rather understandable.
It's normal,
and
yes.
That's normal. And I would do the same thing in your situation. Yes. And of course, what subtle message does that send? Except, well, you know, there's not going to be a consequence. Because if something's understandable, that means it's not punished, right?
Yes.
Exactly. So you think it's safe to confess.
Yes.
So you can go home.
Yes. Yes. As a means for ending for ending the interrogation.
When I was brought to the precinct, of course, I was put in a chair very similar to this. I was handcuffed from behind. And they sat me in this very small room with no windows on the second floor of the police department. And they asked me a very simple question. Did I know anything about someone being shot in the park the previous Sunday? When I said no, the police officer slapped me in my face. And so he said, I'm going to ask you one more time, and if you don't tell me what I want to hear, I'm going to hit you in the head. So he picked up a chair as if to hit me, and that's when I made the confession. False.
Did that happen as quickly as you...
Yes, it did. Because, in fact, you know, one thing about false confessions, especially doing the research, is this notion, and most of it is true, how some interrogations last longer than others in terms of eliciting a false confession, I should say. But in my case, in Willie's, of course, the interrogation process didn't take as long as some of the longer confessions, you know? It was much shorter, so...
How long would you say?
About 3 hours. 3 hours that we were being interrogated. And of course, what happened after that, the interrogation, was the videotape confession that we also made, pointing the finger.
In many cases, the interrogatory part of police interviews, whether that takes 3 hours or 6 weeks, is not recorded. So we're unable to hear or see the manipulation, lying, intimidation, threats, blackmailing, and in some cases, physical abuse, that prepares the individual for their false testimony or false confession. This has the desired effect on the general public of making them think that the subsequent taped or videoed confession is wholly voluntary, and that any untruths about others comes from one's own nefarious motives to implicate them away from oneself. If one looks closely, though, even the final result reveals that the person relating what supposedly happened is not saying what they are saying willingly.
I watched those videos of the four boys who confessed, because Yusuf Salam didn't.
Right.
Their confession, not the interrogations, because the footage that they show is the result of the interrogation, them giving the information that they need to give. And the one that really struck me was the Corey Wise confession. His whole body language, everything about him, tells you that this is a false confession. You can see the remorse on his face when he's fingering one of the other boys. They give him a photograph of the woman, the battered body of the woman, and you see his reaction. It's obvious that he's just stunned that anybody can do this to somebody, and he's, oh my God, is this what I'm confessing to? And he says that Kevin Richardson bashes her with a stone. They say, oh, well, how did he hurt her? And you can see that he doesn't know what to say because he wasn't there. And he's thinking, it's like a child sort of, oh, I've got a great idea. You know, when the teacher's telling you to imagine something and think of something, he does this facial mannerism, which pretty much says, oh, I know. And then he gives the story about a stone that's about the size to hold in a hand. And then afterwards, you see him do this with his hand, and he puts his head in his hand, and it seems to be saying, what a horrible thing to say somebody did when I know they didn't. You can tell the remorse, the guilt that he's going through in that moment, saying that about another boy. And it's so telling. It's so telling.
Towards the end of the interrogation, he made a statement to me. He said, what do you mean you didn't do it? You just told me through the test result that you did. We just want you to verbally confirm it. When he said that to me, that really shot my fear through the roof. It was at that moment that the officer who was pretending to be my friend, he came in the room and told me that the other officers were going to harm me, that he was holding them off, couldn't do so indefinitely, that I had to help myself. Then he added that if I did as they wanted, not only would they stop what they were doing, but that I could go home afterwards. Being young, naive, frightened, 16 years old, not thinking about the long-term implications, instead just being concerned with my own safety. I mean, I was in fear of my life because the manner in which they were conducting themselves was very scary. I was very conscious of the fact that I didn't know where I was, and more importantly, nobody else knew where I was. Being overwhelmed emotionally and psychologically, along with this push-pull dynamic of, on one hand, they've introduced the possibility of harm, and then on the other hand, they've thrown me this false life preserver. I made up a story based upon information which they had given me in the course of their interrogation, and I falsely confessed. By the end of the police interrogation, I was on the floor in a fetal position. I was crying uncontrollably. Needless to say, I was arrested.
When you made that confession, you made up a story.
Yes.
Were you telling yourself, I just need to get this over with. If I give them what they want, then I can go home?
Yes, I was.
You were convinced of that?
I was convinced of that because it was told to me by this police officer who had been my friend. Yes, I was convinced of that. My mother didn't know what was going on. That's why I mentioned this was a school day. She thought I was in school. In New York, if you're 16 years old, then you're considered to be an adult for purposes of being able to speak to the police and waive your rights without an attorney and without a parent being present. This was not videotaped. This was not audiotaped. There is no signed confession. This is just all the police officer's word.
So you never signed a document?
I never signed a document, no. And when they came to court, they conveniently left out the threat and false promise from their testimony.
There are several aspects of what happened in Jeffrey's case immediately prior to his forced confession in New York State in 1989 that are identical to the tactics used on another 16-year-old in Wisconsin in 2006. Brendan Dassey was also taken into the police station during school time so that his mother was unaware of what was happening. He was also cajoled with fake camaraderie by a police officer repeatedly telling him he was his friend. And just like Jeffrey, he eventually went along with whatever the interrogators wanted him to say under the false-fed impression that the sooner he got it over, the better, as then he could go back to school and then home to dinner with his mother. For neither boy did this promise pan out. Little did either of them know that the confessions they were making would mean they wouldn't see a home-cooked meal for over a decade. In neither of their cases was physical abuse actually carried out, but in Jeffrey's case, its imminent occurrence was implied, and Brendan was sufficiently intellectually disadvantaged that he was easy to manipulate through repeated lies the investigators told him about only having his best interests at heart. The persuasion methods used on David were less subtle.
Now, they slapped you around the head and they
slapped me, slapped me in my face.
Right.
And I'm glad Jeff mentioned that, because what happened is, I think, it doesn't necessarily take, and I'm a perfect example of that, and Willie is it as well, that you don't have to be beaten up crazy in order to, for so much physical assault, because just be real about this too, that these law enforcement officials know that they can't do but so much to you, because especially if their expectations, they put you in front of a videotape later on, they don't want you to be badly abused and
right.
Noticeably abused and all these kinds of things. If that was the case, then they wouldn't put you in front of the video. So for me, I was slapped in the face very, very hard and threatened to hit with a chair. And for me, and I can only speak for me at this point, that was more than enough to secure this false confession.
Did they actually hold the chair above you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, they held the chair above you and said, okay,
yes, they did.
Say what
you
need to say.
Yes, exactly.
Did you honestly believe they were going to bash you with the chair?
Yes, I did. Yes, and also thought they were going to go home too, believe it or not. Yeah.
Did they just slap you once?
Or? Yeah, just once.
But that was enough to persuade you
from
the chair. Yes. What about you, Jeffrey? Did they hit you or?
No, it was a threat. I felt I was in fear of my life, though. I mean, and he said that they're going to harm me. I mean, he didn't say, like, it was going to be, you know, one hit, two hits, or how far they were going to go, how long was it going to last. I mean, I felt in fear of my life, because I knew that nobody, I mean, the fact that nobody knew where I was, that was a really large, and then I was not used to being around adult men. I grew up in a single parent household, so I wasn't being, you know, just around. Even when I would go, occasionally go to a friend's house that came from a two parent household, you know, and when I would see the father, I would be a little bit frightened. That was just in general a non-hostile situation, amplified so much more in this hostile situation of this interrogation room. I mean, I was terrified.
So you don't have any brothers?
I have a brother who's 3.5 years younger than me. So there was, no, so it wasn't a quasi-male adult or older, so, no.
Just a year before Jeffrey was arrested and charged on the basis of his false confession, another New York State teen, 17-year-old Marty Tancliff, was tricked into a false confession by police lying to him about his mortally injured father. Marty had awoken on the day he was to start his senior high school year to find his parents stabbed and bludgeoned. His mother had died immediately, but his father was to survive several more weeks.
In the case of Marty Tancliff, he apparently got to the point during the interrogations where he even began to second-guess himself and started to think, well, maybe I had a blackout and did it. Did you ever get to that
point? No. I personally did not. Okay, so the false confession experts, they divide the confessions in half. You have what's called the coerced compliant, where the person knows that they're innocent, but they've been coerced to give a confession. Then you have what's called internalized false confession, which is when the person who's being questioned momentarily doubt their innocence. So in Marty's case, he had been raised to always like respect the police, that they're your friends. So that was a big factor. So the fact the statement coming from the police was a factor. Then they said, well, your stepfather came to and he said that you attacked them. So that's what momentarily caused him to doubt his own innocence. So that's an example of internalized. And again, what's characteristic in the internalized is that shortly after that, the suspect recants. But the recantations are typically discounted. You know, the police being allowed to lie and claim they have evidence that exists that doesn't exist. But that's another thing to look at if evaluating a confession.
Is that legal in every state? The police are allowed to lie?
Yes.
In my interrogation, in fact, the videotape confession is not very long at all. It's like a couple of minutes, a few minutes, actually.
The actual confession.
Right, the actual confession. Yeah, it's not very long.
Like Central Park 5.
It's not very long, right.
Because that's not the actual coercion, is it? You're not seeing the coercion.
No, they're not. You know, and that's the thing. And that's the thing that people, I guess when they see a videotape confession, what they don't see is what happened, what occurred before then.
Right.
You know, the psychological stuff, the intimidation, the good cop, bad cop, all those variables when they come into play here, basically equals it added up to a false confession, which is what happened in our case.
It sounds like they cut to the chase pretty quickly with you within 3 hours, that they threatened you, we haven't got time to mess around here, you're going to get slapped around the head, or
yes,
you're going to get a chair in your face if you don't say what we need you to say. Was there a time gap between threatening? Did they give you a kind of chill-out period so that you wouldn't appear stressed and traumatized on the video and you would look more convincing?
Yeah, there is a chill-out period.
Yeah.
Even though I would say, as I said earlier, my interrogation didn't last long, but there's definitely a chill-out period. And that chill-out period came in our particular case when the assistant DA, meaning the DA that was going to be taking the videotape confessions, they had to call for him, so he had to come to the police. So during that process of waiting for this ADA to come, what they did was they had me sit in the room by myself, of course, for periods of time alone. And I think, and I've learned later on, that was also designed psychologically to have you spend time with yourself to sort of think about what you just said. And how can you somehow say the same thing on video, on camera? Because they did say at the time we waited for the ADA to come. It was about a half an hour. Because then in that process, they played the stall game, said, well, the guy's stuck in traffic, for example, so it may take a little bit longer. So that gives you more time to think.
And did they give you food and drink during that
time? Oh, they didn't give me anything. So what they did was, because they said, well, because I want to call my mom, you know. And they said, well, we will call after the videotape. We'll let you call after the videotape confession. But they didn't let me call her. They called her for me and just simply told her, yes, we have your son. Please sit. You come to court the next morning. That was it.
Because we've just arrested him.
Yes. But they didn't tell her for what, basically. They just said you could show up in court the next morning.
Because I noticed on the Corey Wise video, they gave him a Pepsi, and it really did look like a, hey, good boy, now turn that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So if you smoke cigarettes, for example, they offer you cigarettes.
So they didn't give you anything during that chill-out period just before you did your...
No, just sort of sit there. Of course, a drink of water, it's pretty much it.
I was given something to eat only after I had falsely confessed.
So I feel that the combination of that food deprivation along with the prolonged interrogation had the cumulative effect of helping to wear me down.
Did you get any food after you?
They didn't offer me any food.
Not after you had given them what they wanted?
No, they did not. No, but because I had smoked cigarettes at the time,
yeah.
So they gave me a cigarette.
Oh, okay.
And they gave my co-accuser, when he stuck it, they gave him a cigarette too.
So but only after you'd given
only them? Only afterwards, obviously, yes. Yeah. Not before and during. Yeah, those are tactics that, of course, you learn about these things. In hindsight, you just know that, oh, this was, it was basically premeditated, obviously.
Another common pattern that's premeditated is imparting information about the crime so that the suspect can then regurgitate that in the narrative and then come to court and present it as if this is information that the accused volunteered as their own, and how could he possibly know these details unless he was guilty? The famous quote that's used a lot, right? This is information that only the killer would know.
You know, because I was promised a lot of different things. Most importantly, that after I confess, I would be allowed to go home. And I actually believe that. So what I did was I tried to make my confession more believable than Willie's. So how do I do that? As a 16-year-old kid, I'm saying, I kind of say something to have these officers believe me because I want to go home. Of course, I didn't realize what I was doing fully at the time, but I sounded more enthusiastic about it in terms of my tone. And not realizing that all I was really doing was hurting myself, and him, yes. Even more.
Because from a viewer's point of view, you look really convinced.
Yes.
And you look more convincing. Kevin Richardson, one of the Central Park Five, said a similar thing. He said, you know, I wanted to make it believable, so I was playing up to it more.
Right.
And then there was another quote, Raymond Santana. He said something about the crime took place next to the reservoir, because there's a reservoir in Central Park.
Right.
So he just threw that in for good measure,
yes,
to sound convincing. And obviously that wasn't the case. The crime had not taken place anywhere near the reservoir. And he said that he actually saw the policeman, the investigator, look confused.
So
you're kind of throwing them off.
Right.
The police officer said, you've got to make it look like you're in it. Make it more believable. It sounds like a teacher encouraging a child in a class on a writing assignment. Today you're going to write a story, a fictional story, and I want you to think about this. Make sure it sounds believable.
Right, and so what we call those two are false-fed facts.
Yes.
And so there are many false-fed facts contained in Willie and our confessions, which turned out to be extremely helpful when the new Brooklyn District Attorney investigated our case, because what they did was, they did a compared analysis, examination style of confession. So they saw the false fed facts and found out that our statements were pretty much inconsistent with one another, because if you're going to confess to a crime, particularly when it's more than one defendant or one suspect, then your statements should be consistent, right? They should dovetail off each other.
Yes.
And our confession didn't do that, particularly around the more material aspects of the case. The known facts of the case. So.
Now, were these inconsistencies between two confessions brought up during your trial?
They were, but when you're dealing with a jury trial, and I think what happens is when people see or hear a false confession, or a confession in general, the first inclination, and probably the only inclination at that time, is to believe that it's true. Or else why would a person confess if he didn't do or she didn't do anything?
Okay, and especially because you gave a great performance.
That did not help the cause. Yes, exactly.
There is no record at all of Jeffrey's interrogations or his eventual confession.
It was not videotaped. It was not audiotaped. There was no signed confession. It was just the officer's verbal account of it. And the lack of audio recording and video recording is how, at least during the criminal trial, the officers were able to get away with leaving out the illegal acts which they engaged in. I mean, it's illegal to threaten. It's illegal to make a false promise. But they left that out of their account. And because there was no independent account, that was left out of the trial, and that fact is only compounded by the fact that my public defender did not allow me to take the witness stand to give my version of what happened in interrogation, which most certainly would have included the threats and false promises.
Fewer than half the states have laws requiring law enforcement officers to electronically record some or all interviews conducted with suspects in their custody, and many jurisdictions are resistant to the idea.
Talking about the videotaping of interrogations, I just don't quite understand why. Why is there so much pushback? If the criminal justice system in the states in this country are sick and tired of paying out these large judgments and settlements, why not do the right thing? I mean, who's going to be hurt by the videotape of the interrogations?
An interesting dynamic is in jurisdictions where they are doing it.
Yeah.
While there's initial pushback, but they're mandated by law, and so they do comply, they never want to go back. Once they're doing it, they get used to it. They never want to go back. They realize it really protects them. It makes for better evidence. It's really a measure that's about the accuracy of the justice system. It's not something in order to help criminals get away with crimes. This is about making the system as accurate as possible. Now, and year after year, bills are introduced, and year after year, they go nowhere. It's not passed, and that has to do with the pushback. The main pushback arguments are, well, the public, they won't understand what goes on in the interrogation room, because, you know, we're dealing with criminals here, so they're not going to understand our questioning of them. And then the cost. If you prevent just one wrongful conviction, it's more than paid for itself.
The suspect may know that he's being videotaped. So he may figure that he may sort of circumvent the system.
They'll be less likely to confess. But in jurisdictions where they're using it, there is not a decrease in the confessions. And on top of that, there's no need for law enforcement to let a suspect know that you're being video or audio taped.
Right.
Don't say it. Just do it.
Do it. Exactly. This notion that you contribute to your own conviction, you make a false confession. For me, that's a contradiction in and of itself. It just doesn't make sense to me. Because if it's proven that you made a false confession, then how is it that you contributed to your own confession?
Like, it's like saying, you caused this to happen, so now what? You want to benefit from it? The inflammatory idea, like in Jersey, for example, where Governor Christie insisted that that clause remain in the compensation statute in New Jersey, where they increased the level of compensation up to $50,000 a year. He insisted that that clause that you can't contribute to your own wrongful conviction be left in the bill, vetoing it when it was out. And, you know, the advocates decided to put the clause back in. Then he signs it. He signed the bill. And explaining what his position was and why that was important to him, the governor shares that he doesn't want anybody to take advantage of the system to purposely get themselves wrongfully convicted through this false confession so that you can then exonerate yourself later and be in position to get money from the state.
It doesn't make...
It's very contorted.
It doesn't make...
Who would purposely subject themselves to being wrongfully in prison just in order to get the funds after... Who was a legal beagle to that extent to even understand all those different... I mean, the levels of law you would have to know on the criminal and civil side, this coming from often poorly educated defendants, certainly not people in possession of law degree or any kind of formal legal education. I mean, the whole thing is laughable, except for the fact that it has really serious implications. Exactly. Because it is the order of the day as of now.
Right. I can't wrap my head around that. I just can't. Because so many people are hurt by this, it just doesn't make sense. It should be treated just like the other elements of lawful convictions. But it's DNA.
Misidentification, you know, incentivized witnessing, adjunct science, a forensic fraud, a rogue law enforcement, bad lawyering, prosecutorial misconduct. No matter what the cause is, no matter what, you're still impacted by it and you're entitled to compensation.
Which is why I'm sitting here today.
David's not compensated already, but instead has to litigate because the municipality can argue, well, one DA said false confession innocent, the other one said truthful confession accurate, and you were convicted. So they can try to make a guilt-innocence issue out of that, make the case about that, even though he was exonerated in court. In terms of preventing coerced false confessions leading to a wrongful conviction, of course, one of the measures that's always talked about is videotaping interrogations, which, of course, should be from beginning to end the entire interrogation, which would capture all of the details. It would be clear, of course, what's happening or not with the camera focusing on both the interrogator as well as the interview subject. But it goes beyond that. I mean, in the innocence movement itself, when you talk about preventing wrongful convictions caused by false confessions, conversation always is the beginning, middle, and end as well, videotaping. But that's not the whole thing. It's an important element, but to be sure, but just one piece of the whole. Steve Drizin, who's a noted false confession expert,
He's worked previously on Center on Unlawful Conviction, so he agrees with me that there should be, beyond just a voluntariness hearing, which is what the courts conduct when there's confession evidence, the judge passes on the question of whether or not the confession was voluntary, was the suspect given their Miranda warnings. What there should be is an additional pretrial hearing where the focal point is this confession accurate, in which a judge could look at all these red flags and compare that to a particular instance. And if there's reason for doubt, then not allow that confession to be used, because there is an 80% conviction rate in cases where there's a confession. I mean, in my case, for example, the jury ignored the gold standard of evidence, which is a DNA exclusion. They ignored that and went with this confession. Even without the cop's threat and false promise, there was still plenty of red flags as to what they did testify. They went with a confession obtained under questionable circumstances rather than this evidence. So having this pretrial hearing, I see that as important. And a third measure is allowing a false confession expert testimony into the courtroom. The experts don't give an opinion on a particular confession, if it's false or not. But the experts are allowed to testify as to what are the factors that have been proven to cause an innocent person to confess. Because that information is not within the normal province of the average citizen. And the average citizen are the ones who are on jury. So that helpful information is crucial to a jury evaluating whether to rely on a confession or not. And yet, that expert testimony is not universally allowed into the court system. So those are really legislative items. But then I think on voluntary compliance level, defense attorneys contribute to this conviction rate when it comes to cases that have a false confession, because the traditional wisdom is don't put your client on the stand. But because it's such a high conviction rate, and because the general public just can't wrap their heads around the fact that an innocent person would confess, if you're defending a case where there is a false confession, you gotta answer that confession. You better do it by putting your client on the stand to explain exactly what happened. You have to give the jury a competing set of facts to explain what happened in the interrogation room, or your client is almost certainly going to be wrongfully convicted. So I see that failure of defense lawyers playing it all conservative as adding to that conviction total. My lawyer didn't allow me to testify. Right. I wanted to testify. Mm-hmm. He would not allow me to. And to this day, I regret that I did not take the stand in my own defense.
Unfortunately, jurors seem uninclined to believe a confession was false, even when the defendant gets a chance to say what happened during the interrogation. David did testify at his trial as to how his false confession came about, and he had already had a Huntley hearing, which is a pre-trial hearing in New York State that is requested for the purpose of reviewing the manner in which the police obtained statements from the defendant. But neither procedure was any insurance against wrongful conviction.
Did you say during your trial what happened and why you had confessed?
Yes, I did. Yes.
What effect did you feel that had on the jury?
None, I don't think. I mean, well, honestly, well, kind of after I got the stand, because I was still nervous and all this kind of thing, I got to stand. I felt relieved. And I felt like, you know what? I'm innocent. I didn't do the crime. They're going to eventually find that out. So I wasn't thinking negatively. You know, I didn't think like, you know what? Well, I didn't do a really good job. I also had what they call a Huntley hearing. That's a pre-trial hearing to sort of suppress the confessions before we actually go to trial. And what happened in that situation is I took the stand when most experts said that I maybe shouldn't have done that at a pre-trial hearing. Because what I did was I said one thing at my pre-trial hearing, and then when I got in trial, I said something completely different. I wasn't being untruthful, but I was being somewhat contradictory. So when I met my pre-trial hearing, I said that I made part of my confession up to make my confession more believable than Willie's because I went to law. Now, in trial, I didn't mention the fact that I made my confession up. So when the assistant district attorney, who was, of course, prosecuting the case, brought it to my attention during trial, it looked as if I'm making stuff up.
Did you testify that the police had hit you and threatened you with a chair?
Yes, I did.
Did anyone, detectives, and any of those investigators who had questioned you, did they testify and deny that?
Yes, they did. Only one officer testified, the investigating officer.
Was he the one that slapped you?
Yes.
And he completely denied it?
Yes, he did.
Did you look at the jury when they were listening to you and when they were listening to him, and did you notice any particular
reaction? No. To be honest and fair about that, I didn't look at the jury at all because I was really nervous. Maybe I played a part. But I was very nervous at that time. But I can tell you, if I ever sit in front of a jury again, let's say in civil suit, for example, I would be asked a question, and I'm more confident now I can have a jury explain to them what happened. As a 17-year-old, I was really intimidated and nervous.
Have any of your jurors ever come forward and given their account of what it was like to be on your jury?
No.
For Jeffrey, however, there was some feedback from a juror years later, after he was exonerated. And here we come full circle, back to the importance of food and its role as a determiner of one's well-being.
Yeah, he was a holdout juror. Ironically, as a career, he was a high school counselor, and he had contacted my civil rights lawyer, telling my civil rights lawyer that he saw in the news media that I had been exonerated and that I was free, and that he was happy that I was free because he never thought that I was guilty. And my lawyer asked the obvious question, well, why did you vote that way then? And the juror said that at that time, the vote, it was 11-1 towards conviction. He was the sole holdout. And he said the other jurors were pressuring him. And when a note was sent out from the jury asking the judge whether the jury would have to be sequestered over the Christmas holiday if they didn't come up with a verdict, because the deliberations had gone on for about 3 days, and the judge answered that they would, in fact, be sequestered over the Christmas vacation, then the pressure intensified. And they all wanted to get out of there and go home to, you know, Christmas dinner and their family. And that was why he switched his vote, even though he didn't think that I was guilty.
You've been listening to Juvie, conceived, written, and produced by Zoe Badavinic. Join us next time on Juvie.